It's Monday, the 26th of March, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mazhokar. Coming up on today's show, Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, gives us a roundup of last week's business and political news. And we learn more about Robert McFerrin Sr., the first African-American to sing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Also, our history doctor, Bill Smith, tells us about the presidential election of 1912. Support for KUAF comes from the University of Arkansas College of Education and Health Professions, presenting author Alfie Cohn on Thursday, April 5th at 7 p.m. in Giffel's Auditorium. Cohn, author of 12 books on education, parenting, and human behavior, will share his presentation, Pushed Too Hard, Rescuing Education from an Achievement-Crazy Culture. This event is free and open to the public. 575-4209 for more information. But first, last week, the city of Fort Smith released a report of the progress made in the top strategic priorities and key issues identified by the top city staff and the Fort Smith Board of Directors last summer. I spoke with Ray Gossick, Fort Smith City Administrator, to learn more about these key issues and about how much progress has been made.
Last year, our Board of Directors held a strategic planning retreat and identified six priorities for the Board of Directors and the staff to work on. And those priorities include riverfront development, the Interstate 49 Highway Project, improvements at Ben Guerin Regional Park, an update to our comprehensive plan, fire service improvements, and continuing improvements to our sanitary sewer system to address problems in periods of heavier rainfall.
So how did you identify and establish these priorities? What were some of the criteria?
Well, the Board of Directors actually brainstormed a long list of possible strategic priorities, and then working with a facilitator, they prioritized their long list and agreed on these six projects to guide their interest and the staff's work over the next 2 to 3 years.
When you establish priorities, how do you then establish what needs to be accomplished?
Well, the staff working with the Board of Directors identify the action steps that would be needed to see success on each of the board's goals. And so, for example, on the first goal of riverfront development, the staff identified the steps that would need to be taken in order to provide infrastructure to stimulate private development along the riverfront. And those steps are basically allocating resources and then undertaking design engineering. And then the final step would be construction of the improvements. And so at our Board of Directors meeting last week, the board approved a design engineering contract so that we could begin work on the engineering work needed for the infrastructure extensions along the riverfront. Late last year, when the Board of Directors adopted the city's 2012 budget, they earmarked funds in the water and sewer programs for the design and construction of this infrastructure. So two of the three steps have been accomplished now. But the third step is the most critical step, and that's construction. And that will likely begin either very late this year or early next year after design of the project is completed and we've gone through a public bidding process.
Could you also talk about the goals for other priorities that were established and how the city of Fort Smith has accomplished them?
Sure. Another one of the priorities is improvements to Ben Guerin Regional Park. And there were two specific actions identified there. One was constructing additional softball fields, and the second was partnering with Sebastian County to construct an aquatic center at Ben Guerin Regional Park. One of the steps necessary for that was to work with Sebastian County on a joint agreement, which we did in the later months of 2011, and that agreement was approved early this year. And then another action step was securing funding for the city share of the cost of those projects. And that funding was secured 2 weeks ago in a sales tax bond election where voters overwhelmingly approved using sales taxes to pay for both of those projects. So now the next steps will be to implement those projects, and one of the next steps will be hiring architects and engineers to design the projects, and we'll do that through the remainder of 2012, and then I expect construction to begin in 2013. The two ball fields should be ready by mid to late 2013, and the aquatic center is expected to open for the 2014 aquatic season.
Now, one of the goals of the Riverfront Development Priority was to support the U.S. Marshals Museum, and the museum still needs to raise a significant amount of money before it can start construction. Do you plan to wait until they've reached a particular fundraising goal, or do you plan to start working on Riverfront Development now?
Well, we're hopeful that it will all happen concurrently, and the city is going to stimulate that development by extending water and sewer infrastructure to the riverfront properties. And so that needs to be done to support not only the Marshals Museum, but also development of other vacant property along Fort Smith's riverfront. The Marshals Museum is an independent organization that is undertaking a fundraising effort. They recently concluded their local fundraising effort, and they've now launched a statewide fundraising effort. And when they get near the completion of that, they'll launch a national and international fundraising effort for the museum. So I believe their goal is to raise as much as $50 million for the construction of the museum, for developing exhibits and displays, and also to have an endowment to support ongoing operation of the museum.
What about Interstate 49? Much has been said, but much remains to be done.
Right. Well, there has been some significant progress on the Interstate 49 project through western and northwestern Arkansas. There is some work underway on the Bella Vista bypass, which is a very important part of the Interstate 49 project. And there's been work on Interstate 49 through the Chaffee Crossing area in the Fort Smith region. The next steps that we want to see happen are completion of the Bella Vista bypass, and then construction of Interstate 49 between Interstate 40 and U.S. Highway 71 South. Some portions of that stretch are under construction now, but there has been no construction work done on the portion of Interstate 49 between Interstate 40 and Arkansas Highway 22. And that portion will include crossing the Arkansas River, which will be one of the most expensive pieces of the Interstate 49 project in Arkansas. So we've been working very closely with the Northwest Arkansas Council, the City of Fayetteville, and others to pursue federal support and funding for the Bella Vista bypass, as well as the portions of Interstate 49 in the Fort Smith area. And then there's a larger Interstate 49 coalition that is working on the project for the entire length of Arkansas. So it is going to be a very important interstate linkage through the nation's heartland, and Arkansas is right in the middle of that. And Fort Smith sits at the crossroads of Interstate 40, one of the nation's major east-west interstate highways, and Interstate 49, which will become a major north-south interstate highway through the middle of the United States.
Now, recently, voters in Fort Smith agreed to the extension of a 1% sales tax to refinance bonds that would help the Fort Smith Fire Department and the Fort Smith Parks and Recreation Department directly. How did that extension help in the accomplishments of the goals listed in your priority report?
Well, two of the board's six goals were for fire service improvements and improvements at Ben Guerin Park, and the overwhelming voter support of the sales tax extension 2 weeks ago supports both of those goals directly. Voters, by nearly 4-1 margin, approved sales tax bonds to construct a new fire station in the Chaffee Crossing area of Fort Smith, and also to replace some aging fire apparatus. And by a similar margin, they approved a 0.25% sales tax that will support operation of that new fire station and also provide funding for a wide variety of parks projects.
Now, you established, you identified these specific key areas that you need to focus on as a city. But some of these projects are multi-year projects. Some may take 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, who knows? How do you determine that, okay, even though this is a multi-year project, I will accomplish this particular goal in this 1 year?
Yeah, you know, we have milestones that are accomplished along the way to achieve the bigger goals. And so as we accomplish milestones, that keeps everyone focused and it allows them to see successes along the way toward achieving the bigger vision. So, for example, the result of the sales tax election 2 weeks ago was a milestone toward achieving these broader visions and goals that the Board of Directors has established. And these are all multi-year goals and visions. It's not an annual process that we go through to establish goals. We typically, the board will establish new goals once every 3 to 4 years. So the mayor and the board of directors recognize that these are multi-year goals, and they're significant goals, and they're not going to be accomplished in one-year timeframes.
How does establishing priorities and measuring accomplishments accordingly help Fort Smith in the long run?
Well, these priorities make Fort Smith a better place to live, work, and do business for a variety of reasons. The fire service improvements will allow us to provide a much improved level of fire protection in the Chaffee Crossing area of Fort Smith, which is one of our faster-growing areas in the city. And that's important to attracting economic development, new employers, new jobs to our region, because they want to know that they're going to receive high-quality municipal services if they invest millions of dollars in building a new facility and bringing new jobs to our region. So the fire service improvements are very important in that respect. The park improvements are critical to our quality of place and quality of life in this region. When companies are looking for locations to build new facilities, one of the things they want to know is what is there to do after 5 o'clock? You know, how will their employees spend their leisure time? And they want to know that there's quality park and recreation opportunities available so that the employees can get the greatest benefit from the leisure time they have available. So those are two examples of how these strategic priorities benefit the quality of life and the quality of doing business in Fort Smith.
Ray Gossick is city administrator for Fort Smith. The city recently released a progress report regarding its top strategic priorities identified last summer. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. The Taxpayer Advocacy Panel is looking for a volunteer to represent the taxpayers of Arkansas. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with David Still, the IRS spokesman for Arkansas and Oklahoma. He began the conversation by explaining what the panel is.
The Taxpayer Advocacy Panel has been around since 2002. It's a group of concerned taxpayers who have volunteered to serve and help determine what issues there are in improving the IRS operations and practices. They listen to taxpayers and they provide their own input to help determine how the IRS can improve its efficiency, adjust its systems, and improve taxpayer service.
Is this different from the Taxpayer Advocacy Service?
Well, the Taxpayer Advocates Office sponsors the Taxpayer Advocacy Panel. The difference is the Taxpayer Advocacy Service is a group of employees that are employed by the federal government. The panel is actually taxpayers who have volunteered their time and efforts to work with the taxpaying public directly to provide input to the IRS.
Okay. So why are we looking for a new member?
we look for both an individual member and an alternate member, and we have at least one member in every state in the United States. The current member, her term is expiring in December of 2012. We're looking for an alternate member at this time to be selected, and that alternate for the state of Arkansas potentially would serve at the expiration of the term of the current member.
Okay. What are the responsibilities of being a member?
Basically, a member is asked to provide a significant amount of time, 300 to 500 hours a year, in service to the panel to determine what issues there are among the taxpaying public that the public sees as being something that could improve the operation of the IRS.
So it really is just getting out into the community and talking to the taxpayers and then communicating that back to the panel?
It's not just communicating with the taxpayer community directly. It is also working with the rest of the taxpayer advisory panel and taxpayer advocacy panel in order to work on issues. There are subcommittees and project committees within the taxpayer advocacy panel, of which there are 80 members nationwide, that work on various issues that have been elevated. And they work on what the issue is, how it can be addressed, and what the solutions might be.
Can you give an example of perhaps one of those subcommittees or an issue that...
Well, one of the issues that was recently looked at, in fact, involved determining the readability of certain tax forms. This involves, in fact, this particular issue that I'm thinking of involved a tax form that had shading in certain areas of the tax form that made it difficult to understand or read the tax form. That's an issue with the form itself, but they work on other issues that have overarching effect as well as, regarding the operation of the IRS, as well as the interaction that a tax form might have with a taxpayer.
Has it been successful? Does the IRS, does Congress, do they actually listen to the taxpayer advocacy panel?
Absolutely. The advocacy panel has submitted over the years more than 500 recommendations to the IRS since it's been around, and the IRS has adopted quite a number of those. The taxpayer advocacy panel is viewed as a vital source of taxpayer input to help the IRS improve its operations.
So... the tax day is coming up next month. Does this have anything to do with, we're nearing on that date. Does the fact that you need somebody now, does that have anything to do with that date at all?
No, it does not. This is separate from the tax filing process of the IRS in as much as the tax deadline being April 17th coming up soon.
How does one apply for this position?
Basically, application is very easy. It's visiting the Taxpayer Advocacy Panel's website, that's improveirs.org, and there is the online application process right there.
What are the requirements? Does somebody need to have a background in tax or law or...
A background in tax or law is not necessarily required for work on the taxpayer advocacy panel. Basically, a taxpayer advocacy panel member just has an interest in making things better for the average taxpayer by helping the IRS identify what areas can help improve the operation of the IRS.
Where does the taxpayer advocacy panel meet?
The advocacy panel meets, it can meet pretty much anywhere. I do not know whether they have a regular meeting, like in Washington, for instance, but I do know that we have had open public sessions all around the country, including a couple of them in Arkansas within the past couple of years, in Little Rock, in fact, where the public is invited in to talk about what they think can be done to improve the operation of the IRS. Taxpayer advocacy panel members are important in setting those up and being there to help facilitate those meetings.
Thank you for your call.
I appreciate it.
Ozarks at Largest Christina Thomas spoke with David Still of the IRS from his office in Oklahoma City. To apply to represent Arkansas on the Taxpayer Advocacy Panel, visit improveirs.org. The deadline to apply is April 27th. Every week, we hear from Robbie Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, about the latest in business and political news for the state of Arkansas. He's back again with a roundup of last week's news.
I'm Robbie Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Houston-based QR Energy said it will acquire predominantly oil properties located in four states, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, and Michigan. The $230 million cash transaction involved an undisclosed private seller. The transaction is expected to close in late April. QR Energy noted that approximately 95% of the reserves in the purchase are located in two mature oil fields in the Ark-La-Tex area of southwestern Arkansas. The total transaction involves about 150 producing wells. Two big appointments to Governor Mike Beebe's cabinet. Beebe named Grant Tenniel as director of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and Steve Briles as director of the Arkansas Livestock and Poultry Commission. Tenniel has been serving as interim director at AEDC, and Briles, a former state senator and congressional candidate, has been a deputy director at Livestock and Poultry. Tenniel took over the post after the tragic death of former AEDC director Maria Haley last year. He's been a deputy chief of staff to Beebe since he took office in 2007. Now, Tenniel made some more news this week, albeit not a major announcement. It was still a welcome one. Precision Surveillance Corporation will locate a new $1.5 million facility in Russellville, adding 25 jobs in the region. The company is locating near Russellville to serve the Arkansas Nuclear One plant. The Little Rock Municipal Airport Commission, in a spirit of thinking about tomorrow, voted unanimously this week to rename Little Rock National Airport in honor of Bill and Hillary Clinton. The Clintons were the longtime governor and first lady of Arkansas before their presence on the national stage when, as you well know, Bill Clinton was elected president and Hillary Clinton went on to serve as first lady, a U.S. senator, a former presidential candidate, and the current U.S. Secretary of State. The commission cited the many contributions the Clintons have made to Arkansas through more than three decades of service to the state and nation as its reason to rename the airport. The controversial Keystone Pipeline project, which was put on hold by the Obama administration over environmental concerns, is likely to be developed after the November 2012 election, says U.S. Senator Mark Pryor. Pryor toured Wellspun Pipe in Little Rock, the Indian-based pipeline manufacturer that stands to benefit immensely from production of Keystone. He says that election year politics has stymied the project for the time being. Wellspun, which recently announced a $100 million 200-job expansion at the Little Rock Port Authority, said the Keystone project could rehire 60 or more workers that it laid off after the original moratorium. Electronic games of skill, those casino-style games at Oaklawn in Hot Springs and Southland in West Memphis, set new monthly records in February. Oaklawn had its biggest month in history, pulling in $81.5 million in electronic gambling wagers. Southland nearly doubled its coin in from last February. The Dog Tracks Casino raked in $173.7 million for the month, also the most in Southland history. I'm Robbie Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
Robbie Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, brings us the latest in business and political news for the state of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large. The International Relief and Development Organization, Oxfam America, in partnership with Good Magazine, has nominated Bertha Gutierrez, a Springdale, Arkansas resident, for the International Women's Day Challenge. The challenge hopes to highlight women who are making a difference in their local communities. One of 52 nominees, Gutierrez has been nominated for introducing Las Fotos to Northwest Arkansas. The project teaches young women about photography, art, and self-expression. If she wins, Gutierrez will receive $1,000 to continue her work. Gas prices in Arkansas continue to rise, according to the website arkansasgasprices.com. The average gallon of gas in Arkansas yesterday was $3.72, about 30 cents higher than a gallon of gas in the state on the same day last year. Arkansas's average gallon of gas is still cheaper than the national average of $3.86. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team now sits alone at the top of the SEC West standings after taking two of three games from Mississippi State this weekend. Arkansas is 5-1 after winning in Starkville yesterday by a score of 8-5 in 11 innings. The Razorbacks will next play at LSU next weekend. Arkansas is ranked 3rd in the nation and LSU is ranked 11th. The matchups for the NCAA Gymnastics Regionals will be announced today. Arkansas will participate in the NCAA South Central Regional, which the Razorbacks are hosting in Barnhill Arena on April 7th. Five other teams will be invited to the regional. This weekend, the Razorbacks, ranked 10th in the nation, finished 6th at the SEC Championship meet. It is Monday, March 26, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar, and with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, some weeks you kind of struggle to have weekday things to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't one of those weeks.
Yes.
There's an artist talk tonight at 5:30 at the Hembree Auditorium in the Agricultural Food and Life Sciences Building. I should have taken a deeper breath at the university with artist George Dombeck.
Hmm.
Whose work is all over the walls at Tyson Foods and in Crystal Bridges, mm-hmm. and is gorgeous. He does things with watercolor that I don't even understand how they're possible.
The first time I saw his painting that is up at Crystal Bridges, I thought it was a photograph.
With the water drops?
Yes.
It's stunning.
And it took me some time and some effort to really observe and see, oh, okay.
I think getting to listen to him talk about his art would be fascinating. So that's at 5:30 tonight. The Working Adult Book Club is going to talk about Moonwalking with Einstein tonight at 6 o'clock at the Bella Vista Library. You know, they're doing these re-releases of films. And Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, recorded in 1999 with Donny Osmond.
I have not seen this.
It's showing at 7 o'clock. Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville, $15.
Okay.
Stage performance recorded in 1999. And the Science Fiction Book Club meets at Nightbird Books tonight at 7 to talk about Hull 03 by Greg Bear. So that should be enough for one Monday.
Okay. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
What manner of man is this? All nations in him are blessed. All things are done by his will. He spoke to the sea and the sea stood still. Now ain't that a witness for my Lord?
Robert Keith McFerrin was born March 19, 1921 in Marianna in Lee County, then went on to international acclaim as a baritone opera singer, a music teacher, and for fathering a subsequent generation of musicians, including Bobby McFerrin Jr.
Nicodemus was a man desired to know how a man can be born when he is old.
The son of a Baptist preacher, Robert McFerrin was the fourth of eight children. He gained attention for his singing and whistling talents early on, but was only allowed to sing gospel music. He attended grade school in Memphis, Tennessee. It was only when McFerrin began high school in St. Louis, Missouri, that he began formal, non-gospel music instruction.
In the morning when I rise, give me Jesus, give me Jesus.
In the 1940s, Robert McFerrin attended Fisk University for a year, was drafted and served in the Army, and then returned to college. And he kept singing. He moved to New York City in 1948 and married vocalist Sarah Copper in 1949. The same year, he made his operatic debut in Verdi's Rigoletto. McFerrin also sang in the world premiere of Troubled Island, composed by fellow Arkansaser William Grant Still. McFerrin's January 1955 debut with the Metropolitan Opera in Aida was the first time a black male had sung with the New York company. Unlike Marian Anderson's celebrated debut 3 weeks earlier as the first black female to sing a principal role at the New York Met, McFerrin's debut went largely unheralded.
Laugh and sing and dance for two instead of one. What no wrinkle on your brow, nor how, because the sorrow of the past is all done.
In 1958, Robert McFerrin and family moved to Los Angeles, California. McFerrin had been contracted by film director Otto Preminger to sing the part of Porgy in Preminger's film version of George Gershwin's opera, Porgy and Bess. In addition to singing the part, McFerrin worked with Sidney Poitier, who played Porgy on screen, to teach Poitier to correctly lip-sync the songs. The soundtrack and film were both successes. McFerrin set up a vocal studio and stayed in California for 15 years before returning to St. Louis to perform and teach.
Vendeste il mio bene, ma è nulla per loro sconviene, ma mia figlia impagabil tesor, arrendete o sei pur disarmata, questa man per voi pur attrenta. Intera più buona paventa se dei figli difende l'onor per la volta assassini, assassini aprite il portale porta assassini ma aprite.
Despite McFerrin's many accomplishments on his own, his name may be best known through his musical children. Daughter Brenda McFerrin as a vocalist and Robert McFerrin Jr., or Bobby McFerrin, is a multiple Grammy Award-winning vocalist and conductor as well. McFerrin Jr. enjoyed an international pop smash in 1988 with the song Don't Worry, Be Happy. It was the first a cappella song to ever hit number one in the U.S., in addition to adorning countless t-shirts, ball caps, and Big Mouth, Billy Bass animatronic singing Fish. Of his father, the younger McFerrin said, "His work influenced everything I do musically." Robert McFerrin Sr. suffered a stroke in 1989 that affected his speech, but not his singing. He continued to perform for years afterward. In 2003, Opera America awarded McFerrin a Lifetime Achievement Award. Robert McFerrin Sr. died November 24, 2006, in St. Louis, where he had lived since the 1970s. Having shaped many lives through music and teaching, Robert McFerrin was 85 years old. Here in its entirety is Arkansaser Robert McFerrin of Marianna and Lee County with His Name So Sweet, showcasing McFerrin's gospel origins combined with his operatic training.
Just come from the fountain, I'm just from the fountain, Lord. I just come from the fountain, His name's so sweet. Well, Lord, I just come from the fountain, I'm just from the fountain, Lord. I just come from the fountain, His name's so sweet. For sinner, do you love Jesus? Yes, yes, I do love my Jesus. Sinner, do you love Jesus? His name so sweet. Well, Lord, I just come from the fountain. I'm just from the fountain, Lord. I just come from the fountain. His name so sweet. Last leader, do you love Jesus? Yes, yes, I do love my Jesus. Leader, do you love Jesus? His name so sweet. Well, Lord, I just come from the fountain. I'm just from the fountain, Lord. I just come from the fountain. His
sweet. Sad Lord, do you love Jesus? Yes, yes, I do love Jesus. Lord, do you love Jesus? His name's so sweet. Just come from the fountain, I'm just from the fountain. Oh, just come from the fountain, his name's so sweet. Oh, Lord, I just come from the fountain. I'm just from the fountain, Lord, I just come from the fountain, his name so sweet.
Arkansas-ya Robert McFerrin of Marianna and Lee County with His Name So Sweet. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. In case you're not counting, we are. The presidential election is in exactly 234 days. 2012 is not just an election year, it is also the 100th year anniversary of one of the wildest, most intriguing races for the White House in the country's past. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums discussed the election of the year 1912 with our history doctor, Bill Smith.
This is Ozarks at Large. As we head toward the fall elections, talk in the air once again of third-party candidates being involved as we get closer to Election Day. Here to talk about the last great run by someone not from the Big Two, our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be here, Kyle.
You're obviously talking about Reform Party and Ross Perot.
No, actually not.
Not John Anderson?
Nope.
George Wallace, who carried Arkansas in...
That's very interesting,
okay.
But not today.
Dixiecrats?
No, I was thinking of the great Progressive Era Showdown of 1912.
I was not, so help me out.
Well, there's a recent book by James Chase called, very original, 1912. And the current resurgence of progressivism is what got me thinking about that book and this fall's events.
You mentioned progressives. We've talked about progressives before in this segment. This brings them to the forefront?
Everyone claimed to be a progressive in this election, and that's one of the real sort of fun fact things about it politically. The sitting president, William Howard Taft, was the Republican who had busted more trusts in U.S. history than any other president. Remarkably, in only 4 years in office, he started off saying, of course, he was a progressive. Then there's the former president, Theodore Roosevelt, who after failing to win the GOP nomination, went out on his own and, of course, called himself a
progressive.
And the Democrats went with the former New Jersey governor and former Princeton president, Woodrow Wilson, who clearly also was a
progressive.
In this race, you also, though, have an outsider group that really thought themselves to be progressive and the other three not so much. It gets me thinking about outsiders, kind of like Ron Paul's supporters, who are convinced today that there's no difference between the two main parties. What you had in 1912 was Eugene V. Debs and the Socialists, the fourth party candidate, who thought the other three were just all the same.
Well, when you have historical hindsight and you see these names, Teddy Roosevelt, who had been president, William Taft, who was president, Woodrow Wilson, who had become president, and then Eugene Debs, it sounds like a dynamo of an election.
It is. This election really had it all. It's the first time you've got a former president running third party. You had a former president run, that would be?
Grover Cleveland.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
very
when
good.
He won his second non-consecutive term.
Exactly. You have two major academics involved in this, four major parties going for national voting power, and assassination attempts.
Assassination attempts. I think you know what? I don't think you're talking about history today. I think you've grabbed an old script from 24.
No, this is not the unshot season, and Jack Bauer is not involved, but... This is another great example of how truth is stranger than fiction. And I just pull this one little nugget out of the 1914 run and this book to sort of illustrate that. You've got Teddy Roosevelt, a very charismatic speaker, very popular on the stump, going out and speaking to various groups. He is on his way to a speech. And an assailant who was trying in his mind to prevent a monarchy and stop a third term because, Roosevelt had become president for almost a complete full term,
after
courtesy
McKinley.
Of the McKinley assassination,
right.
had his own reelection, and now, in many people's minds, was going for a third. So this assailant steps into the crowd, shoots Teddy Roosevelt at point-blank range, and it gives us one of the great TR legends as he refuses medical treatment and insists on going ahead and giving the speech.
Quite a buzz among the crowd.
And I think we can clearly say that here is one of the few times, as we do this series, that we can say there is a distinct difference in how the Secret Service would handle the situation today. Even a candidate, much less a former president as candidate, would have not had the option. He would have been rushed off to the hospital. But he arrives at the hall where his supporters have, of course, heard the news and are reasonably panicked, as they would think. So his very arrival both excites and calms the crowd. He walks onto stage, asks the crowd to be quiet, as he has been shot, and he is weak, and his voice is very quiet. And all this drama, reaches into his suit coat, pulls out the blood-soaked speech, which in some ways helped save his life because it had slowed the bullet, the big, thick speech in his coat.
Really?
And then he proceeds to speak for an hour and a half.
Politicians. okay. So you have a Roosevelt in this election, but he's not a Republican.
No.
Where he had been before.
No.
Bull Moose, right?
Exactly. He had tried to take the party back from the sitting president, his hand-picked successor in William Howard Taft.
This is like a soap opera.
It is. Failing that attempt, his supporters would walk out of the convention, form the Progressives, but as you said, they are better known by the nickname associated with their standard bearer, the Bull Moose.
The Republican in the race is the incumbent, President Taft.
That's right. And a perfect example of the power of the sitting president. Even though Roosevelt won most of the primaries, which were held at the time, but let's also remember, in this period, the early 20th century, there were far more caucuses.
Right.
And then some states would not have a caucus or a primary. They would simply have their Republican or Democratic Party apparatus.
The backroom deals.
Exactly, the backroom deals. So the power in the sitting president was that he could wire the reelection against someone, against an insurgent such as Roosevelt. And that is, of course, what made the delegates so upset that they walked out of the convention.
Uh-huh.
By the time it's all over with, though, you know, Taft is going to actually confide in his closest advisors that he would rather see the Democrat win than Roosevelt.
Ooh, and the Democrat is, of course, Woodrow Wilson.
Right. You've got the governor of New Jersey actually running.
Yes, yes.
For president. Sound familiar? Dr. Woodrow Wilson, Southern-born and Northern-educated, had been the president of Princeton before moving into state politics. And in the book, this is another one of those great little side stories that Chase gives us, is the unusual path that leads the former president of Princeton University to the governorship of New Jersey, and how it really was a failure on Wilson's part with Princeton's faculty and alums getting him run out in many ways of the job that, you know, drives him from academia to politics.
Now, you also mentioned, you said that there were two academics. Obviously, of the former president of Princeton, the other academic is
Teddy Roosevelt.
That's not how we usually think of Teddy Roosevelt.
No, he's a prime mover in natural history. You know, when you think of the collections at the Smithsonian, many of his great hunting events.
The national parks. Yeah.
Exactly, in the national parks. But he wrote a four-volume history of the West and served as the president of the American Historical Association in 1912. So, you know, you've got an individual who is far more bookish than his image that he'd like to portray was. And, you know, in some ways you could argue that there were three, because Taft will leave office after losing the election and become a law professor at Yale for several years and the president of the American Bar Association before he returns to federal government as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1921.
But Eugene Debs is involved in this as well.
And I think, as I'm looking back at the book that Chase wrote, this was one of the great surprises, because he takes Debs and elevates him to equal status with the other three and makes it, you know, a Fab Four election rather than the big three that most people would teach this in a survey. You get a glimpse into the backstory of Eugene V. Debs and the labor movement and his critical role in bringing that forward, and really a look at an unrest that was bubbling underneath this, you know, split of the Republicans and battle with the Democrats that Eugene V. Debs embodies.
Well, the race seems pretty obvious where it's going to go.
Well, not at the time.
Yeah, I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight.
We have the benefit of hindsight. But at the time, there was quite a bit of fear going, depending on who you're backing, as to who was going to win this race. It's one of those, we've talked about it before, the most important election of our time,
yes.
time. You know, and
coming to an election box near you
exactly
at any time.
Every 4 years. But this one did have a little bit more of that. You've got the sitting president really kind of hoping that his predecessor doesn't win. The election votes, when you tally together the Republicans, they clearly would have run had to a victory if Roosevelt hadn't split the party and led the way open for Wilson. It's just a fascinating race politically. But then you look at things like the grand plans, new nationalism from Roosevelt, which was going to get him labeled as a totalitarian, and Wilson, the Democrat, running under New Freedom, trying to counter the central control of the Republican candidate, a complete role reversal of the stereotypes we today would associate with Republican or Democratic candidate.
Well, if Teddy Roosevelt as the Bull Moose, or if Eugene V. Debs, the progressive, had managed to somehow get the White House 100 years ago, do you think that would have changed what libertarians and Reform Party and all third parties would love to see now? Do you think it would have split it open a little bit, or would have been an anomaly?
I think it would have just been another sea change, because if Roosevelt had won, he would have either pulled in pieces of the Republican Party and the Republicans would have morphed into a progressive. If Debs had won, you might have seen pieces of the progressives, the more little L liberals that were associated with Roosevelt, breaking off into that. And just as, you know, you saw the change in 1800 and a lot of the originalists fading away, the Federalist Party disappearing, the Whig Party disappearing in the middle of the 1800s, you would have seen probably one of the parties fade away. And because our whole system is kind of rigged for two, I don't think we would have gotten into that European sort of scenario in which you see two, three, four parties, or even a Canadian situation where you have a pretty standing three-party system.
You know, HBO had a wonderful series a couple years ago about John Adams. This would make a great 11-episode series, don't you think? I mean, you've got a candidate getting shot. You have four candidates. It'd be fascinating.
I think that's what has always brought me back to the election of 1912 and the progressive period. It's just some fascinating politics. It's some fascinating history. There are a lot of echoes to today. But Chase's book, and I just come back to this being one of the more unique ideas for a beach book this summer, but it's a quick read. It's in paperback now. And if you have any interest in this type of fast-paced American history, and especially if you think history's boring, you pick this book up, and you're right. You'll be thinking this should have been a screenplay.
Well, until we find ourselves with sand between our toes,
we're history.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 26th of March, 2012. It's the birthday of A.E. Housman, born Worcestershire, England, 1859, the poet who gave us the lines, "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough, and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide." It's the birthday of Tennessee Williams, Columbus, Mississippi, 1911. Wanted to become a playwright when he was 18 and saw a production of Ibsen's Ghosts. His father made him go to work in a shoe factory, where Williams worked with a man whose name was Stanley Kowalski. He wrote plays while he worked a variety of odd jobs, plays produced by small theater companies. Didn't earn him much money. He was nearly broke in 1944 when The Glass Menagerie was produced. A big success, first in Chicago, then on Broadway. 3 years later came A Streetcar Named Desire, with Marlon Brando playing a character named Stanley Kowalski. It's the birthday of Robert Frost, 1874, in San Francisco. Moved to Massachusetts when he was 11. Struggled to become a poet. He was 39 before he published his first collection of poems, A Boy's Will. Robert Frost, who was out of fashion almost from the beginning, interested in traditional meter and rhyme when his contemporaries were writing in free verse. Early years were rough. Father was a heavy drinker, died of TB when the boy was 12. Family was left impoverished. Frost had to drop out of college during his first year to go to work. He was so depressed at one point, he walked into the dismal swamp and considered drowning himself. Taught school for a few years, never enjoyed it. He and his wife Eleanor lost their first child. He fell into despair, barely making ends meet, his marriage on the rocks. That was the year he tried his hand at raising poultry on a 30-acre farm in Derry, New Hampshire. The farm inspired some fine poems, but Frost was a terrible farmer. And it's the birthday of the poet Gregory Corso, born on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, New York City, 1930. Gregory Corso, who said, "Standing on a street corner, waiting for no one, is power." His parents were Italian teenagers. Mother went back to Italy, left the baby behind. Corso said, "I never saw my mother. I don't know what happened to her." The father was drafted into the army. The boy spent his childhood in a series of orphanages, foster homes, jails. When he was 16, went to prison for 3 years for stealing food from a restaurant. In 1950, he met the poet Allen Ginsberg. Corso had started writing poetry in prison, and he became one of the leading poets of the Beat movement. Here's a poem by Robert Frost on his birthday, A Prayer in Spring. Oh, give us pleasure in the flowers today, and give us not to think so far away as the uncertain harvest. Keep us here, all simply in the springing of the year. Oh, give us pleasure in the orchard white, like nothing else by day, like ghosts by night, and make us happy in the happy bees, the swarm dilating round the perfect trees. And make us happy in the darting bird that suddenly above the bees is heard, the meteor that thrusts in with needled bill and off a blossom in mid-air stands still. For this is love, and nothing else is love, the which it is reserved for God above to sanctify to what far ends he will, but which it only needs that we fulfill. A Prayer in Spring by Robert Frost, from his collected poems, prose, and plays, published by the Library of America and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by Ella's Restaurant, located at the Inn at Carnell Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. Ella's offers a variety of fine dining experiences during breakfast, lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. An Indian lunch buffet is served each Tuesday. Menus, event schedules, and more information available at ellasrestaurant.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Dry Fork, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, pursuing peace through education at arkansas.edu/Fulbright. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. Thanks for listening and have a great week.